I don't know what's real. I don't know what's not real.
Limited Capacity is a collection of six darkly amusing stories about the mysterious ways we interact with the internet and with each other.
There's something going on with him. It's like an act. I don't trust him.
What?
You're staring at me like I should say something, but I don't really know what to do here.
That's the whole name of the game. Don't talk about how the town isn't real. Do you understand?
Limited Capacity. Available now on CBC Listen or wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a CBC podcast.
In the name of Jesus,
in the name of
Satan, you bow your knee.
Satan, you bow your knee.
You fall on your face.
You fall on your face.
COVID-19.
Guys, listen.
I just want to say this is the best part of my week.
I'm with you. Like, I'm telling you right now. I'm delivering a keynote speech in like an hour, and part of my talk, I'm talking about like things that I'm grateful for, and dudes, I'm just grateful. Honestly, like this has like been the highlight of my quarantine. Has been just sitting down on these Fridays and trying to feel good with you guys. However, I need to preface. This Feel Good Friday episode is we're going to, you know, as we've been doing, we've been
feel
throwing
real Friday.
Yeah. As we've been doing, we've been throwing to, you know, we've been like farting around and making each other laugh for like, you know, 20 or 30 minutes, and then we throw to these conversations with like specialists and it's like usually like really interesting topics and like kind of the, you know, the conversations are usually pretty fun, at least for us. Like they're fun. I don't know how you listeners feel, but I'm assuming that you're having fun with us. But this week is a little different. We throw to a conversation with our new friend Dr. Sinha, who is a geriatrics specialist in Toronto, and there's not
it's
a lot
hilarious.
Of, no, it is not. There's not a lot of feel good. It's feel real. It's Feel Real Friday. Cause Sinha dropped some realness it's an important conversation.
It's great that you prefaced this conversation with that, Jer, but like we'll just let people feel that way when they get to that part of the conversation. We'll have some fun beforehand.
And that's what I wanted to say to you two right now is let's make sure that we have some silly goose times right now so that when we get to that conversation, people are like, you know what? I'm ready to feel bummed out. So having said that, guys, I fucking need to read to you this article that blew my mind. Also kind of like weirdly timely. So this past Wednesday, so 2 days ago, we put out our weekly Turn Me On episodes. And the episode was specifically about, we had a conversation with a guy who runs a company who sells action figure models is what they're called. All right. That's the term that's supposed to be used. What it really is a sex doll. We most of us know them as sex dolls.
But, hold on. What is it? An action figure?
Action
model.
Action figure model. Okay. And so it was actually
with circular open mouth.
Well, listen. All right.
I should be called surprised action figure model.
hey, listen, all right, listen.
Raised eyebrows and everything.
As a part of Turn Me On podcast, we were trying to destigmatize sexuality. We were trying to normalize the conversation of sexuality. And this guy that we had on, Don, who runs a company that sells action figure models, you know, there's a lot of stigma attached to those. Hey. Hey, man. Don't. Listen. Hey. There's a lot of stigma attached to those. There's a lot of stigma attached to those dolls. And because here's the thing is that those dolls aren't necessarily only bought for intimacy. They're actually used in many other ways. And yes, they most certainly can be used that way, but they're not necessarily only used that way.
Exclusively.
Exactly. Right. Now, so it's actually a really like wonderful conversation that we had with him, and kind of like enlightening and beautiful and kind of changed my outlook on what like an action figure model doll or a sex doll could be used for. And in terms of like people who find a lot of like comfort in those things, in those like products. Right. So we're having this conversation, yada, yada. It's really fascinating. And then I find this fucking article on CBC, a CBC.ca sports article. This is coming from South Korea. South Korean soccer team slammed with record fine for putting sex dolls in seats. So this is this article came out yesterday on Thursday. FC Seoul could be expelled from own stadium over incident. This is
whoa.
Wackadoo. All right, listen to this. Listen to this.
So, okay.
South Korea's K-League said on Wednesday, K-League is like the league of the FC.
It's a really big league. It's like the Premier League of Korea.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Sponsored by K-pop.
South Korea's K-League, is that true? Or was that because I'm like that could be true.
Just thrown in there because everything from Korea is something.
Yeah, right, totally. South Korea's K-League said Wednesday its disciplinary committee decided to impose a 100 million won fine, which equates to about $113,173 fine, on FC Seoul.
About
roughly exactly that.
About specifically.
$113,000 fine on FC Seoul.
Per doll.
For using sex dolls instead of mannequins to fill empty seats in their stadium.
Dude, what's the difference if the point is to have them sitting there watching a game?
Were they clothed? Were they wearing jerseys?
Well, listen to the rest of the article. The club placed dolls in seats during a K-League match on Sunday to make up for the absence of fans due to COVID-19 restrictions. Quote, the disciplinary committee decided to take heavy disciplinary action considering the graveness of the incident caused by the real doll, in quote, which actually, there you go, good. Action figure model. We're moving in the right direction. Real doll that has greatly insulted and hurt female and family fans. Why would this hurt? Why are you singling out female fans? And to prevent similar incidents from going forward, K-League said in a statement. The club apologized on Monday, saying that they had failed to check the consignment sent by the supplier, though adding it was not aware that the dolls were adult products. Though the incident was not intended, it was possible to distinguish the dolls from ordinary mannequins in the club, and the club has made a serious mistake by not removing them when it had enough time before the game started. So, okay, there's a picture here. These dolls, these models, I'm going to use the word action figure models, okay? They're being used in a way that is outside the realm of being fucked. Okay, they're fully clothed. They're holding fucking signs like "Go rah rah team." They're wearing masks. They put masks on them.
They're probably cheaper than mannequins, and they're probably lighter than mannequins, which makes them far cheaper to ship. And
I was going to say it's
crazy.
I'm putting the link in the chat. Go look at that photo.
No matter what was happening in the game, they would always look surprised. So like, you're like a player on the field and you like do a cool move and literally 100,000 audience members they just look like
the realest mannequins you've ever seen.
Yes,
that's all they look like. And they just look like real people.
And just because you can fuck it doesn't make it bad.
Dude, imagine if like a bunch of people came to the stadium and they were like, hey, wait, you can have sex with these people. This is wrong. And they got mad that there were people in the stands because you could fuck them.
I'm so bummed about it. And like, and the fact that they make this like about like a, like the fact that they try to make this about being insulting to women. Like, come on, man. This is like, what did I call them?
Action figure models.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks. There's male action figure models, you fucking dummies. Come on.
But did they buy any of those? No, they just put up cardboard. They just put up cardboard cutouts. And you know what? If they really were pro women, then they would have spent the money on the male action figure models.
This bums me out. Dude, you know how much the fucking dolls cost? Yo, actually though. Those dolls, like Dawn's dolls. First of all, I asked Dawn, I said, hey, on the Turn Me On episode, I was like, listen, if I was going to like get a 5'2" doll with all the fixins, like how much does that thing weigh? And he was like,
all the fixins.
They weigh like 85 to 90 pounds. And I'm like, this one
in the white shirt looks like she's got all the fixins.
They're huge.
My God.
Hey, listen. Whoa. Hey, dude.
You know what, though? I want to say, though, because the people listening to this can't, they're probably not looking at the photo right now. If you can look at the photo, go and find
this
article.
Just go to CBC. Yeah. Google CBC Korea sex doll. And.
But I will say, the thing I want to say is that, you know, when you first read the headline and you were like, they put sex dolls in the seats, I was like, oh, man, I can see how that might be a bit of like an oversight and a bit of an oversight. Like I can.
And
I
you
can
were thinking of it like
would,
the sex doll that like
I was
the
thinking
sex
there was a bunch
Dennis
of naked sex dolls. So I was going to tell
that
story.
Yeah, but they're not naked.
Too,
but they're wearing FC fucking.
When you sent that photo through, I looked at it, and it looks like fans in the crowd. Like, they have face masks on to cover their surprised mouths. They have shirts and jerseys. They look like real people.
They look like mannequins. The reason
they're
using those dolls is because those dolls are literally one step away from ex machina. Like, you put a fucking computer chip in their head and allow that thing to walk around and talk. It's the robot from Ex Machina. Like, it's so, they're so realistic. It's crazy. Also, I wanted to say, these dolls, they cost.
But that was the weird thing about Ex Machina, was like, you were always in the back of your head, you were going, is this just his sex robot?
Yeah, well, man, come on. There's more than just sex. These dolls can cost upwards of like $6,000.
Could you not just drill a hole in a mannequin and like sand it so it's not rough and have sex with that too? Like, couldn't you just do that?
Everything is
tech. I'm making the point that everything is a sex doll. Any doll could be a sex doll if you really want it to be.
Yeah, absolutely.
You could go to a Hudson Bay that's closing down. Just scoop up a couple of mannequins that are scheduled for the dumpster. Drill a hole wherever you want. Sand around the edges now. And you're set.
The last thing before we leave this topic, which I think we should very quickly, I do want to tell you about the time when my brother couldn't get a date to semi-formal, so he actually brought a sex doll to semi-formal as his date, and he put a dress on her.
It's an action figure model, Brian.
This one was straight up sex doll.
Did he fuck it at prom?
Well, I didn't ask him, but I assume that maybe afterwards he was probably feeling a little bit.
Well,
you know.
But at prom he probably didn't. He was probably dancing with it and like having a sweet time. And so again, action,
just figure, like a real human
action figure model. All right, but just fucking get it seared into your goddamn head.
But you know what he brought. Don't you think that that's something that at a high school they would be like, oh, this is a little bit. I don't know if this is within the guidelines of what's allowed, but I think the teachers that
volunteer to chaperone those things are the teachers that are like, this is hilarious. And also, I will let you smoke weed in the middle of the gym floor.
Dude, you know Mark Frank, like our best friend who's a fucking school teacher, you know he'd love that shit. Like, that's right up his alley.
Oh, yeah. He'd be like, this is brilliant.
All right, no more sex doll talk, guys.
All right, fine. We'll move away from the sex doll talk here, guys. Cue up the video about the strip club in Portland.
I meant action.
So we're going to move from real action figure models to real life humans models. So this is a strip club in Portland, and this is a workaround that they found to keep operating in a really unique way throughout COVID, through the quarantine.
A local event company hit us up and said, hey, we'll come set up all the infrastructure for tents, music, lighting, sound, stages, stripper poles, and now we have a drive-through window that just happens to have go-go dancers in it, and we're calling it Food to Go-Go. You order your food at the beginning,
Food to Go-Go.
And inside the tent, there are four go-go dancers in there, two poles and a DJ. We've got a fog machine, lighting. You pull in, and you get one or two songs with the go-go's, and then we bring your food out to you, and then you go on your way. We created barricades.
I like how it's a food drive-thru, too.
And over. We're handing out free rolls of toilet paper to, like, the first 50 or 60 cars. We're continuing to keep our kitchen guys working.
It's the only place in Portland you can get toilet paper.
Dancers, you know, we've all kind of switched gears. Every small business is feeling this pain.
So you can pause it there. So this strip club in Portland, this isn't the first time that they've made the news since the quarantine. It's the same strip club. I don't know if you guys read this. It was the same strip club that, in order to try to continue to give work to their kitchen staff and their dancers, they created Boober Eats. And so the idea was they had people that would call or like text in or call in for food, and then their models would or their dancers would show up with the food at a person's door.
The real life, like, action figure models.
The real, yeah. Real life action figure
hey,
models.
Hey man, listen. And so they would deliver food and like give a dance like on their patio or whatever. In like sexy clothing. But then Uber Eats fucking like cease and desisted them. And so then they were like, oh, fuck. So they hit the drawing board again, and then they came up with the go-go dancing drive-through, which
top marks for creativity and initiative.
I think it's brilliant, man. Ingenuity.
I love that. I have several friends that are dancers, and you know, it's like that. It would have been so easy for them to go, well, we're fucked. I guess we can't continue. Mm-hmm. In this climate, but instead, you know, the owner of this place is like, guys, let's figure this shit out. You know, let's hit the drawing board and come up with any and every idea that we can that will like incentivize mm-hmm. people to come in here and support what we've been doing. And I love that shit. I just think it's so great.
What a feel good Friday piece of content. You know,
I know, right? And you know what? I always do. I'm just you know, to with a little phrasing salute to our friends across the pond in the UK. I'm always chuffed to bits when we can when we can have the most insane, ridiculous conversation, and then throw it to something that is you know, super, super real. Talking to somebody who just represents the utmost professionalism and distinction in their field and in their career, and that they get to then be so proud of their association with us, and that in the same episode that we discuss strip clubs and sex dolls,
no action figure models. They, Taylor.
It's really.
You know what?
Say frankly, it's sad that he's going to share it out to his listeners and and they get a half an hour of this first.
Hey man, I don't want to talk about what our show is and what our show isn't. But this is one of the things that I love about our show, because we can simultaneously mix the silly and the goofy with the surreal and intense. And having said
we
that,
we fit no mold.
That's right. Dr. Samir Sinha, he is the director of geriatrics at Mount Sinai, Toronto. And he, you know, we're about to tap into one of the most grave one of the biggest and frankly saddest issues surrounding COVID in our country right now, which is the detrimental effect that this has had on our elderly population and on long-term care facilities, especially here in Halifax. You know, Northwood has been in the news, I mean nationally, with how badly the residents of that facility have been affected by COVID. And so we talked to Dr. Sinha. He really doesn't hold back any punches, and he takes a generous amount of time here to really point out the issues that we have been that have come to light in terms of how we care for our elders here in Canada, and the changes that we hope to see come from what we're learning right now. One little heads up here, we're doing this from the comfort of our homes, and we're having these remote guests. Sometimes we run into some like technical issues. The audio quality is a little bit janky here and there, so just excuse that. But aside from that, take the time to sit down and really listen to this conversation, because it is vitally important. Our elderly population is just as important as anybody else, and Dr. Sinha takes the time to really really hammer that home.
And I do just want to add that you know, as dark as it can be talking about this stuff at times, like I did feel hopeful coming out of this, and I feel like he does paint a picture of what a solution could look like. Mm-hmm. and you know, I think that we can learn a lot from this, so I hope you guys take that away from this conversation.
That's right. So enjoy this conversation, and we'll see you on the other side. All right, we jumped over some hurdles. Technology was not on our side, but we made it through, and we are sitting here with Dr. Samir Sinha. You're calling him from Toronto, and I'm excited to talk to you because you are the director of geriatrics at Mount Sinai Toronto, and we are living in a very unique time in the world, but in particular I feel like your specialty is something that the world is in like dire need of right now. You know, I guess where I want to start with this is like 3 months ago, while COVID slowly started to spread across the world, there was this this very unfortunate narrative going around, especially here in, you know, in North America, where I was constantly hearing even people in my own social circle saying things like, oh yeah, COVID, you know, it's starting to spread, but like only old people and people with compromised immune systems really have to worry about that. And that really rubbed me the wrong way because I have cystic fibrosis, and I was like, whoa, that's fucking me. Like you're talking about me. Yeah, I do have to worry. But it turns out that not only old people and not only people with compromised immune system have to worry. Everybody should be worried about this because it is a virus that doesn't discriminate. It's a virus that can knock, you know, just about anyone off their feet in a really severe way. But one thing that we have definitely seen since this has really gotten out of hand and has spread vastly across our country and across the United States is how much of an effect it's had on our elderly population and how much of an effect it's having on long-term care facilities. And in particular here in Halifax, there's a lot of news coming out about Northwood, which is a long-term care facility. And so I guess the first thing I want to ask you is, what is your take on everything that we're currently in right now? Like what is your world looking like right now in a world of COVID compared to pre-COVID?
Yeah, thanks, Jeremy. The issue with COVID is that it's something that's kind of turned everybody's world upside down, including my world, where I was, you know, just focused on caring for older patients and really helping help them stay healthy and independent for as long as possible. And COVID's been one of these interesting beasts that's really kind of exposed a lot of truths and a lot of vulnerabilities that we have in our society. But, you know, the first thing is, you know, you said something that I disagree with. You said, for example, that COVID doesn't discriminate, but it absolutely does, right? COVID does not attack everybody in our population in the same way. Mm. If you're poor, if you live in a crowded housing situation, if you're immunocompromised, which, you know, you've told us you are, if you're old and you're not young, these are the many ways in which it's actually preying on certain people. And that's part of the reason why we take a bunch of older, vulnerable people, many with immunocompromised situations, many of the folks at Northwood, for example, 70% of people living in our long-term care homes live with dementia, meaning they don't know what's going on sometimes, and they don't remember about the importance of physical distancing and not wandering and touching and washing their hands. And so it's a recipe where COVID-19 has particularly attacked with absolute fortitude. It's preyed on the vulnerabilities of people themselves, certain citizens, and the ways that which we've actually treated them. And that's why when I think about the three most vulnerable populations right now in Canada, we're seeing those who are not just only immunocompromised, but those who are older, those particularly living in long-term care homes, those who are homeless, and also those living in our correctional facilities right now. That's where we've actually seen the most severe outbreaks. And what's challenged me is that I was just minding my own business, trying to improve the healthcare system. And all of a sudden, you realize there's not many of me out there. Mm-hmm. There's only 300 geriatricians in the country. And yet we're now at the forefront of trying to deal with an epidemic that has already claimed 5,000 lives in our long-term care homes, mostly older adults. So that's a little bit about what my world looks like at the moment.
Well, why are there so little amount of geriatrics? Did you say geriatricians? Is that the...
Yeah. So
why are there so few?
Well, so that's a $1 million question. Number one is we don't tend to value the weak and the frail and the vulnerable in our society. As you know, number one is if you go back to 1900, our life expectancy in Canada was only 51 years of age, right? And when we actually created Medicare, our beloved Medicare in Canada, and our universal healthcare systems, but in Canada in particular, the average age of Canadian when we set up our universal healthcare system was 27 years of age. So if you think about a national healthcare system for 27-year-olds, the last thing on your mind are like medications per se, or nursing homes, or home care. Because the average 27-year-old out there, they need a hospital and they need a doctor if they're pretty sick. And so we made sure we covered that. But now the average Canadian is much older. And we've realized we've actually built a healthcare system that didn't really take into account older people. And as we've actually started to age as a society, you know, we're more obsessed right now with anti-aging than we are with aging. And as more and more of us are older in our society, you'd be surprised to find out that at medical schools, you know, just down the road from Northwood, Dalhousie, for example, or any of the medical schools in Ontario, they don't necessarily mandate geriatric training at all. And if they do, it's far less than the training we get in pediatric care. So I'll give you a stat just to prove my example. Right now in Canada, we have 75,000 doctors, and we have 9 times as many pediatricians in our country as we do geriatricians. So 9 times 300 equals 2,700 pediatricians. And yet, just about 2 or 3 years ago, older people started outnumbering younger people for the first time in Canadian history. And we don't have the physician support ready to meet the needs of an aging population, nor do we have people graduating from our medical schools knowing how to care for older adults.
I'm interested that I'm kind of fascinated that ratio is what it is, especially given the, you know, very obvious and sort of like, you know,
maybe looming is not the right word, but I'll go with looming, that baby boomer population that is massive, and that are in their geriatric, that are moving towards their geriatric years, and that does it look like there is that it's going in that direction? Like there are being more people more interested in going into that field, or is it not really ticking up at all, even though the population to serve that need is growing?
Well, I'll give you an example. When I started practicing geriatrics back in 2010, when I hung up my shingle in downtown Toronto, there were about 250 geriatricians. So the good news is we're now up to 305, right? But at the same time, in that same period, we added almost 2 million more older Canadians because our baby boomers started turning 65 back in 2011. Mm-hmm. And that older population is going to double within the next 10 years. The 85 and older population is going to quadruple. And the fastest growing segment of our population are what we call centenarian, those who are 100 and above. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, so we have a few more people doing this care. But our medical schools haven't retooled. Mm. Our society hasn't said, wait a minute, we need to have more home care and more care to meet the needs of an aging population. I think we're just kind of hoping that maybe this virus would come along and, you know, dare I say it, just kill off all these problems. But it isn't doing that. It's only exposing the fact that we're so underprepared.
Well, do you think that on that note that it's exposing this situation to a degree that we're actually going to be able to now, more of an apparent problem, and that we can now actually equip ourselves to handle that or shift that a little bit?
You know, Brian, great question. And I think it's really hard to bury 5,000 bodies or to hide them, right?
Right.
That's the death count. And we're only 6 weeks into this pandemic, if you will, right now. And we know that this pandemic is going to go on for another 18 months or so at least. So, you know, there will be more Northwoods. Quebec and Ontario, people have been seeing the headlines coming out where things have gotten so bad, we've had to call in the army. We've had to actually try and shore up the staffing in these homes by getting people from hospitals and local school boards involved just to try and make ends meet. And even the military now is saying, wait a minute, like we could help out for a month, but this looks like it's going to be a problem that's going to go on for a long time. Mm-hmm. And right now, Quebec is missing 10,000 workers in their care homes right now. So, yeah, we can't ignore these problems. And it's just sad that it's taken 5,000 deaths to earn a Sick Boy podcast, right? But right. I'm hoping that
we didn't need all those deaths. We could have arranged this beforehand.
we could have, but we didn't. And you know, and maybe the best thing that'll come out of this is that someone listening will also agree that right. enough is enough. And I think the big thing is our prime minister now, our minister of health federally, our premiers of Ontario and Quebec, our health ministers, our long-term care, they've all said, yeah, the system's broken.
Yeah.
We need to fix the system. They're now all talking about inquiries and commissions and all these sorts of things. But, you know, the sad part is we've been through commissions and inquiries, and we still haven't fundamentally changed a system of care, because it's going to mean we got to put more money into this. Mm. It means that we've actually got to pay people who provide this care better. It means that we actually have to recognize that we've got to do a much better job caring for older adults. And I don't know whether or not we're still ready to think about them when there's so many of us here as well.
Is there a society, you know, except like Japan jumps to mind as like a society and a culture that just places it. They just have a different fundamental value for elders in their community. That's like a culture that jumps to mind. But are there healthcare systems or around the world, countries around the world that are doing a job that, you know, Canada that people around the world probably associate with, you know, good healthcare and all this stuff. But is Canada looking to anywhere and saying, you know, we love what they're doing. Can we do more of that?
Absolutely. And I think
Here's a few things. Number one, right now, when we look at all the countries around the world that have been affected by COVID, Canada has this dubious honor of having the highest rate of its deaths occurring in long-term care homes. So that's the first thing there. And then when you actually look at countries that were devastated by SARS, our last major coronavirus experience, you need to just look over to South Korea. You need to look at countries like Taiwan and Singapore, where they actually haven't had any deaths in their long-term care homes. Why? Because after SARS, they realized that these coronaviruses can be highly contagious. They can spread between facilities very easily, that people have to be isolated in mass, and that they realized those lessons really well, and they implemented them. So these were the countries that were closest to the pandemic when it started in China, and yet they haven't recorded a single death in a care home. Why? Because they learned their lessons and they applied them. And we have 5,000 people dead in these homes already. Mm. And we had our own SARS commission, because remember, Canada was actually hit badly by SARS, but we learned about what it could do in hospitals. We never applied those lessons to our long-term care home. Now, when you look at a country like Denmark, for example, Denmark's a country that I like to hold as a great example, because they're a country that has a universal healthcare system, but they included things like medications, home care, nursing home care in their system. And in fact, many years ago, Denmark realized that, wait a minute, how many of us listening or how many of us speaking aspire to end up in a nursing home? Well, nobody really does, right? But we want to have a good quality home available if we need it. However, what Denmark realized a number of years ago was healthcare costs were spiraling out of control. Right now, we just did a study through our National Institute on Aging last year that showed that over the next 30 years with our aging population, our long-term care costs, that's home care and nursing home care, are going to more than triple from $22 billion to $71 billion if we do nothing differently. So we've got a big bill that we're going to be responsible for if we do nothing differently. So what did Denmark do? They actually said, well, wait a minute, where do all of you guys want to live? Where do you want to end up aging? How many of you want to live in a nursing home? Nobody raises their hand. And so how about this? How about if I tell you instead of spending $71 billion, we could spend a lot less, and I can give you guys home care, and so you can actually stay more healthy and independent in your communities. And that's what Denmark did. And by doing that, what they substantially did was they didn't build any new nursing home beds for 20 years in their country. And the better part was, because they are actually providing more care for people in their home that was cheaper to deliver than in an institution, they actually closed thousands of hospital beds. Why? Because they didn't have people having to wait, you know, they didn't have to wait in the hospital to go to their own home because they had a bed in their own home. They just needed that care, which is cheaper to provide. But when you build an institution, it costs $150,000 just to build the bed. And then it costs a ton of money to staff that and organize that. Mm-hmm. When every Canadian, well, most Canadians have a home and a bed they can sleep in. And it's just about being creative. And that's what countries like Denmark have done. And that's why they've really shown us examples of how you can reorient things in a sustainable way and deliver the care that people actually want and need.
Do we have any fundamental barriers to that at all that like that, you know, that makes it challenging for Canada to do that? Or is it, you know, I want to say as simple, it's obviously not simple, but is it really like looking at Denmark and saying, hey, we want to pilot this program and see if doing what Denmark did, which worked, will that, like, we want to see if that works in Canada.
You know, Canada is always one of these places. Anywhere you go, they say, well, we're different, right? You know, maybe we should do it this way. There's also a lot of political forces at play, right? This stuff takes time and effort to actually do. But I don't think we need to pilot this. I think there's so much evidence around things that we could do better around the world. How do we fund this? Well, there are actually good mechanisms that Asian countries and European countries have created called things like long-term care insurance. It's where we all kind of fund a system that's sustainable, because I don't know if you have $71 billion lying around, but I can tell you in 30 years from now, the long-term care costs that we expect will happen if we do nothing differently, that'll be half of the personal income revenue that we're generating at that time. There won't be any money left over to actually pay for other things unless we really hike taxes much further. Mm. But there are sustainable ways to fund this, and we've seen this in other countries. Number two,
we know exactly what we could do, and we know that we can do all of these things, but we just need the political will and finally, you know, the interest to actually do it. And we owe it to ourselves. And frankly, why? Because if we're going to be selfish, and if any of us are planning to live beyond the age of 65, and most Canadians will, the life expectancy is now 82, then we actually have to make sure that we actually change these things for the better. So we can do this. We know how to do it. We just have to just get down and do it.
Sick Boy Podcast will be right back after this word from our sponsors.
Think of your favorite one-hit wonder.
Or that overpriced toy your parents would never let you have.
Or that TV show that no one else remembers because it was canceled way too soon. Now what if we could fix it? I'm Francesca Ramsey.
And I'm DeLon Grant. And after 20 years of friendship, we are now hosting a new nostalgia podcast called Let Me Fix It.
Each episode, we'll dig into our favorite celebrities, shows, and brands of yesteryear, and then imagine what it would take to repackage them for relevance today.
Think of our show as an intervention, but with way less stakes.
So subscribe to Let Me Fix It wherever you get your favorite podcasts.
It's so striking to me that you say, you know, like if you asked a group of people who wants to end up in a nursing home, that everybody would say, well, certainly not me. Yet, you know, it seems like it's the only option in a lot of ways for us here in Canada, given the way that the system is currently set up. And it just makes me dread someday thinking about being old when like there could be the beautiful, more cost-effective situation of staying at your own house or in your own residence.
I think this has brought the reality home because, again, a lot of people are related to the 5,000 who've died. These are people's grandparents. These are people's parents, their aunts and uncles. And right now, if you realize that, well, why did Grandpa end up at Northwood, for example? Well, because he couldn't get enough home care. And my God, home care would have been cheaper. Why didn't we give him more home care? And a lot of people who end up in nursing homes in Canada, it's a point of last resort. You know, we actually had a term in Britain 100 years ago called the poorhouse. Because basically, if you don't have any money left over, and I'll tell you this fun fact, the average Canadian who's retiring now, who's going into retirement, okay, who doesn't have a workplace pension, and only 30% of Canadians now are retiring with a workplace pension. I'm not talking about CPP. Mm-hmm. I'm talking about, you know, a pension from the school board or a pension from the hospital. The rest of us, you know, 70% are retiring with only $3,000 in the bank on average. So if you're relying on government-funded home care, which is quite meager, and you don't have $1 million in the bank to pay for your own private, you know, home care service and everything else, you only have one option left if you want to live, and that's you go to a nursing home. So 85% of the people in Ontario nursing homes can't even afford their own rent, right? Yeah. It's just telling you it's a system that we've created. And this is why, you know, when you start looking at what the future could hold, you know, how many people right now in Halifax are thinking if they get an offer at Northwood, they want to go in tomorrow, right? You know, nothing against the staff there by any means. The staff there are incredible people. But the people, you know, we fund our nursing homes just at the outset so poorly that to cut costs, you know, or to try and make ends meet, these homes, you know, what they end up doing is they only give people part-time work. They don't give them benefits like pensions or sick days, things that you would get if you work at the local hospital. But we fund the system so poorly, this is what forces people to work in multiple homes. And it's why whenever a job pops up at the hospital, people are, they're hightailing it out to go to the hospital to get a better paying job for the same type of work. So fundamentally, again, we have to realize that if we're not looking forward to aging because this might be our future, we have the power to change it. And we have the power to fund the system that can deliver much better care at a cheaper cost as well.
So, okay, I'm glad you said that. It makes me want to bring up. So, like the whenever I'm faced with this notion of like of like really staring down a system that's broken head on, it's hard for me in the chair that I'm sitting in to feel like it's a very helpless feeling, right? Obviously, there's the people higher up than me that make all the decisions, and it just feels so out of my hands. So, and maybe there, I don't know, maybe I'm not gonna like the answer to this, but like, what can people like us do to help push the system towards a resolution that is far more far better than what we're currently sitting in, what we're currently facing?
I think the simple answer is just vote, right? So it was fascinating because back in, so again, 2011, the baby boomers started turning 65. And if there's one group of people that our politicians fear the most, it's the older population. Why? Mm. 80% of them vote. They vote twice as the rate that millennials vote right now. So they're the most politically engaged, and you know what? They're the fastest growing voting segment in society. And for a lot of them being closer to maybe needing a nursing home or home care, I don't think they're going to be very keen to vote in any future government that's not going to fix this and fix this for good. But here's the deal. All of us actually have something in common with the baby boomers. We're all going to age, right? Mm. If we play our cards right, the average Canadian lives till 82, and those of us who make it to 65 have 20 years of life expectancy ahead of us, and about, 10% of us, 1 in 10, will need care like this in future. So the key is that in 2015, in the last federal election or two federal elections ago, the number one healthcare concern of Canadians was having enough home care available. And so what did we see? We had the three federal political parties get into a bidding war. The Liberals pledged $3 billion. The NDP pledged 1.8. The Tories that lost the election, they pledged zero, right? And when the Liberals finally had to negotiate the last health accord with the provinces, they actually ended up spending $6 billion over 10 years to try and shore up our home care system. So that was because people were voting and the politicians were saying, wow, the federal government has no jurisdiction over home care, but my God, if that's what Canadians want, we'll throw money at this issue and try and see if we can make it better. But it's not just about throwing money. It's about saying, how do we fundamentally allow the system to be reorganized in a sustainable way? And I think this is where we need to have more thoughtful things rather than political announceables to get your vote and make you feel like maybe you solved the problem when we didn't.
Yeah, it's interesting because, I guess it's all on how you present it too, right? Because if you're talking to a bunch of baby boomers and politically you're saying, well, we don't want to invest money into nursing homes. They're in their minds, they're thinking, well, they need to be funding nursing homes. That's where I'm headed for. When the reality is like, if we take the money and take it out of the nursing homes and put it in places like home care, then that's going to ultimately be a better solution for them. But I guess it's like, Is there a general consensus that like, oh, this is what we need to do? Like, we need to take the money out of nursing homes and put it into home care? Because this is kind of like the first time that I've heard that idea, but I would be worried that older populations would think like, oh no, we need to be funding nursing homes better, when maybe that seems like it isn't the solution.
Yeah, no, it's a great question. So I'll give you some stats again. When you look at the major economic countries around the world, the average spend, if you take $100 in the whole sector of long-term care, which should include home care and nursing home care, the average country around the world spends about 30%, 1 in 3 of its dollars on home care and about 2/3 of its dollars on nursing home care. In Canada, we spend 87%, 87 cents on the dollar goes to nursing home care and only 13% on home care. And then, get this, if you go to Denmark, 60% of their spending or 66% of their spending is on home care and only 1/3 on nursing home care. Now, The next thing is, if you ask any person who's a baby boomer, what would you rather age in your own home that you've lived in for the last 30 years or go to the nursing home down the street, they will more quickly say, I'd rather be in a home in my own home then go to a nursing home. So That's the reason why the federal government, two elections ago, basically pledged money for home care, not nursing home care, because that's what the people who vote were saying they wanted. So But you don't get this. In the Ontario election, you know, that recently occurred, there was a bidding war amongst the three political parties there, which boggled my mind. All three political parties were pledging to build 30,000 new nursing home beds. That's what they were pledging. And the three political parties were like, I can build them faster than you. You're going to build, 30,000 in 10 years, or I'm going to build them quicker. This garbage, because frankly, when you actually look at the cost that we need to actually spend to build beds, and I'll tell you, in the last 2 years, how many of those new beds have been built? Zero. Why? Mm. It takes years to build a bed. And then, you know, here, who wants to go into a bed in the first place? Now, we will need more nursing home beds, don't get me wrong. But the key is home care is cheaper. It's more in line with what people want. And we have great international examples of how that actually works. And so I'm going to again say that if there's one issue that would unify all generations, because if I ask you guys, and I don't think any of you are baby boomers, and neither am I, how many of you would rather have home care than nursing home care if I could tell you that could keep you at home? Mm. I think we'd all say yes. And I can tell you, every baby boomer feels the same way. Yet, you know, here's the challenge. Here's what I really think is the reason why we have this love for nursing homes. It's because it's easier to cut a ribbon in front of a shiny new building, you know, for that great photo op showing you're doing something. And it's really hard to cut a ribbon in front of any of your homes and say, you know, in Brian's home, there's more home care going on. Trust me.
But there's so many more ribbons to be cut that way. You know what I mean? It's like there are like way more photo opportunities if you actually invested in those ribbons.
You know what, Jeremy? You know, next time I meet with the minister, I'm like, imagine this. Yeah. We actually have millions of people receiving home care, and we'll cut ribbons in front of
everybody's home at everybody's home.
Yeah.
So something that we've been discussing and debating, and you know, we did a little live show last night, and we were talking about it then. Is what starts to happen to these more vulnerable populations, people like Jeremy with suppressed immune systems, people who are over a certain age, people who are living in long-term care facilities, anybody that's in that circle, what starts to happen as we start to open things back up, and there's no vaccine yet, and we're reopening businesses, and you know, gatherings of people are starting to, you know, the limit on gatherings in different provinces is starting to rise, and there's still no vaccine that really protects the people that are most vulnerable, like Jeremy, like geriatrics. What is the advice that they are going to get?
Well, this is the challenge, and this is what scares a lot of us, right? Like, we actually were so, you know, concentrated on trying to keep our hospitals ready to try and meet the onslaught that we thought would, when we expected another Italy or New York to happen. Mm-hmm. And we're lucky that that didn't happen, because we were great as a country to start our lockdown earlier than others. And we were really good overall at physical distancing. So that was great. But what we showed was that we have so many of these systemic issues in our long-term care homes. And in certain parts of the country, they were far slower at implementing proven measures that we figured out could prevent COVID. That's partly why I think Northwood was as bad as it was, mm-hmm. right? That's why I think BC's done a tremendously good job in stopping the outbreaks and keeping less than 10% of their homes in outbreak. And meanwhile, in Ontario, we just crossed 25% of our homes in outbreak already. So the challenge now is that, okay, so we're getting things under control. You know, things are now starting to turn the corner a little bit. But now we're going to let everybody run around once again. And the problem is once we start opening up our borders as well, COVID spreads, right? This is a virus that's sneaky. This is a virus that spreads easily, especially with its asymptomatic presentation. And the real concern here is that, you know, think about a place like Prince Edward Island. Prince Edward Island, 150,000 people, right? One of my former trainees, Martha Carmichael, is the geriatrician there. She called me up about a month or two ago saying, what do I need to do to protect my nursing homes? I've got no COVID and I want to keep it that way. Mm. And so I said, you know, this is what we need to do. She implemented everything. You know, they've been great. But here's the challenge. Prince Edward Island, it's the land of Anne of Green Gable, right? It's a great place where people want to travel to during the summer. So now all the planes start arriving from across Canada, and all of a sudden from New York State and throughout the U.S. where COVID's out of control, and from other countries, and all of a sudden you reintroduce it into the community. Mm-hmm. It then starts spreading around, and then those people who are vulnerable, people like Jeremy, for example, who's just minding his own business out in the community, he shakes your hand or whatever. He gets too close and doesn't, you didn't have a mask on. Or workers get it in their own homes and then they actually bring it into the long-term right. care homes. The thing is, we're going to have more and more outbreaks. We're going to have more and more deaths. And the sad part of it, you know, if I'm being absolutely honest, is, you know, people are saying we've got to tolerate a certain loss of life. Like, we might lose Jeremy along the way, but as long as our hospitals don't get completely overwhelmed and our healthcare system doesn't collapse, well, this is called the collateral damage because, you know, I'll be damned if I keep staying at home and we stall the economy because we care so much about Jeremy, or we really care about those people in those homes who are going to die anyways in a few years. So what's the big deal? And I think this is where we've got to balance, you know, our, you know, kind of that Canadian approach where we've got to support each other as a country to be absolutely vigilant, but be smart about it, because until we have a vaccine, and you know what the sad part is, we might never get a vaccine. COVID might be here to stay, and it's going to keep preying on all those vulnerable populations we talked about if we don't get this under control.
Go ahead, Bri. Yeah.
I was just going to ask one last question about COVID-19, and I am curious, you mentioned it earlier about how South Korea learned from SARS and implemented new things that had a significant impact in a positive way on how the geriatric population there experienced this new coronavirus. Can you give us any example or idea of what they did? Because, you know, SARS wasn't that long ago. So it seems like they must have learned some type of lesson and implemented some type of change that has been, you know, immensely effective over the short time between SARS and now.
Yeah, so South Korea is an interesting story because, you know, they were affected by SARS and then more recently by MERS, the Middle Eastern Respiratory Syndrome, for example. And there was a big national scandal there because the people felt that they just didn't handle that virus as well as they could. So when coronavirus came knocking this time around, the government didn't waste any time. They got experts together. They said, you know what, we need to create tests. So South Korea started creating massive testing capacity. They were doing incredible job contact tracing as they started having these outbreaks. And they made sure they sealed off their nursing homes. They made sure that if there was a case that was reported, they isolated that individual well. But they also had taken precautions from before. They learned that we shouldn't have people living in two to a room or three to a room in a nursing home. If you have one person in a room only, which is more expensive to build, but frankly, it's safer to live in. Mm. You know, these are the things that they applied. And that's why it's South Korea, it's Taiwan, it's Hong Kong, it's Singapore. We've seen countries that were deeply affected that did these things. Now, in Canada, we started realizing by the end of March from the CDC in Atlanta, there were things that we were getting completely wrong in our nursing homes. And we started having that evidence available, but we had some provinces and territories not implement those things that we needed to do until mid-April. And what people have to realize is that in a pandemic, what we actually can see is that every single day that you delay implementing an important step, that can see an increase by exponential rate in the number of deaths and the number of cases. And so I think one thing we've really learned is that speed is important and that you've got to be quick, you know, when you're dealing with this. And frankly, as we look towards the future now, you know, as we start opening up, there will be outbreaks, there will be things happening, and we've got to be ready to get on top of it. Because if we don't, we could lose control again so easily.
Yeah, that's my big worry. It's like, you know, we're reopening and people are, I think a lot of people have the mindset that like, oh, we're reopening and we're done with COVID-19. Like, we're reopening and that's that, you know, but that's, I feel like that can't be the mindset. Like, we need to be ready to respond instantaneously if there's a second wave that starts, right?
And we're already seeing it, because in the U.S., where they never got it under control in many cases, and many of the states have already started to open up. I just heard a disturbing dispatch this morning that said, I think it was in Alabama, where they've opened back up already. They only have, they're now seeing climbing rates of people in hospitals again. They said that they're now down to only 9 free ICU or critical care beds and ventilators right now. And they're going to have to start deciding who gets that vent pretty soon. And that's an example of a place that said, okay, we're ready to reopen. They were never ready to reopen. And we're just going to start seeing how, unfortunately, we're going to see a lot more tragedies along the way. And this could be an ongoing story for the next 18 months. And that's why it's going to take another wave, frankly. And we haven't lived through a pandemic yet in our society without a second wave to date. Mm-hmm. So there will be a second wave. I hope I'm completely wrong here. But the question is, we have to make sure we take this seriously, or it's going to take more of us.
Dr. Sinha, this is, you know, it's really funny. It's like our Friday episodes were like, it's Feel Good Friday. These are the episodes where we're trying to like cheer everybody up. This is, but you know what? This week, it's Feel Real Friday.
Sometimes you need just a dose of truth.
Reality. That's right. So I want to say thank you for coming in here and keeping it real and giving us a lot to think about, because this is obviously very important. And it really means a lot that you carved time out of your busy schedule to sit down with us this evening.
Yeah.
And I'm really glad that we were able to make it work. So thank you so much for everything, and keep up the work that you're doing, because it's obviously very important.
Thank you very much, guys.
Okay. Well, there we go. I hope you're still feeling good on this Friday. again, remember, if that real talk left you feeling maybe not so good, which is very valuable or totally valid and okay, what I would suggest doing is just rewind to the 0000 mark of this episode and listen to the first 20 minutes. Where we just talk about real life action models and
fake life action models.
And fake life action models.
So, and sex dolls.
Hey. That is it for this week. Thank you all so much for tuning in.
I'm Brian.
I'm Taylor.
And I'm Jeremy, and this is Sick Boy.
For more CBC podcasts, go to cbc.ca/podcasts.